the SR2 committee, call to order. And we are going to start with an informational meeting. The Department of Fish and Wildlife and the wild fish policy as presented by Mr. Ed Bowles, Director of the Fish Committee. And Mr. Bowles, respect to Representative Devlin, who will be coming in sometime, we may stop this presentation and move to a public hearing on one of the bills and then come back to it. Since he is in committee, he's going to try to break away at a convenient time in his committee. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Director for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm pleased to provide
Can we do that right now?
You bet.
Mr. Devlin is here. We'll close the public, or the informational meeting, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3124. And Representative Devlin is going to explain the bill to us. Good afternoon, Representative.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 3124 today. For the record, I'm Representative Richard Devlin from House District 24. I sponsored House Bill 3124 because it will seek to expand the ability of the Oregon Health Division to educate and inform individuals and groups that are at risk of harmful consumption of contaminated fish. House Bill 3124 does three things. First, it provides for an assessment of the public health risk associated with contaminated fish. Second, it allows the dissemination of information to be impacted within for impacted individuals and groups. Third, it evaluates existing studies related to contaminated fish and funds a limited number of additional studies. As an example, the consumption of contaminated fish from Oregon rivers can be a direct cause of human exposure to mercury. Even at very low levels, mercury exposure is dangerous. The development of children and fetuses can be impaired by exposure to mercury through fish consumption directly or through the mother's consumption. The Oregon Health Division currently issues advisories regarding consumption of fish from the Willamette River and other basins. However, my understanding is that communication about fish consumption warnings has sometimes been insufficient. Permanent fish advisories are generally posted, and temporary problems with fish contamination are typically published in newspapers. Unfortunately, barriers such as language and poverty may prevent many of the people who most need and understand the warnings from getting the message. House Bill 3124 provides a good starting point for developing a more effective fish consumption outreach program. It will increase public understanding of the hazards associated with consumption of contaminated fish and prevent individuals from consuming those fish without proper knowledge or warning. I thank you for hearing this testimony, and what I might say, I usually don't read testimony, but I'll go off from reading it now because I generally don't really even like to read testimony, but I thought it was important to get this on the record. This is a bill that was considered during the 99 session. It had four hearings during the 99 session, and it then went from the Water and Environment Committee to Ways and Means, where it died. I think there's been plenty of evidence in the last couple of years since the last session that there are cases, particularly of individuals who are non-native speaking, particularly pregnant women who happen to be members of those groups, who may be eating contaminated fish and not knowing the hazards of doing that, particularly for their unborn children. This bill is actually a relatively small bill. Its limited purpose is not really the purpose of some people occasionally assigned to it. Its limited purpose is merely so that people will not engage in an activity that could be a danger to their unborn children. It's a relatively small expenditure. The real battle for this bill will be, again, in Ways and Means, trying to get it funded. I might also point out that the governor did request from the Oregon Health Division that they include it in their proposals for budgets for this biennium. But as it went through that process and the governor narrowed the budgets of various agencies, the item actually got cut again. from the Oregon Health Division's budget, so I'm here trying to get it back in again.
Thank you.
Richard, thank you for speaking in front of us today. Do you have a sense on how much money this would cost?
I think the amount that's in the bill itself is about $300,000. What we did in the last time it was considered is we pared that number down to about $200,000 by basically doing some of the normal things that the legislature does, deferring the start date out into later into the biennium, and actually limiting some of the additional items that we felt would be beneficial, but that we could probably do without for the first biennium that this was in place.
Follow up?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard, for those of us who are new on the committee, new to the legislature, it seems a fairly innocuous bill. What was the opposition to it?
Actually, I think part of the difficulty with the bill in the last session, just to be perfectly as frank as I can, this is a bill about contaminated fish and the dangers of human consumption of those contaminated fish. Somehow it got tied into whether or not the Willamette is an appropriate drinking source for water, and we tried to explain to people over and over again that those are two completely distinct issues. The fact that a fish that grows up in the Willamette, in the lower level of the sediment areas of the Willamette, might be contaminated with mercury does not mean that if you take water from the Willamette, it goes through a treatment facility, that it isn't clearly, you know, relatively safe to drink. They're two entirely separate issues, but somehow there became a connection between the two in the last session. And I think a lot of people were leery about it because of a perception that somehow it would enter into the debate about whether the Willamette should be an appropriate drinking source.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Other questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Representative Devlin. I'm looking at the bill, and I don't see anywhere in there where it says just mercury. It says pollutants. So.
That's correct. I used mercury as an example. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I used mercury as an example.
So you're saying this would be a broad base, any pollutants, what are considered pollutants?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I am obviously not a biologist, but it would be that I guess you would have the normal range of toxicology studies that are done on fish. One of the things that the bill anticipates happening is it would give the resources to the Department of Health to hire a toxicologist. I would think in that case that they would be examining for probably a number of contaminants. I'll give you an example going to a different area again here. If you go onto their web page, in terms of like looking at water systems, they list potential, probably dozens of potential contaminants there that they test for. If you look at their advisory page for their current fish advisories, there are a number of contaminants listed. If you actually go to some of the EPA pages, which have direct links to states that have fish advisories, you will see a number of contaminants listed. As I said, I'm not a toxicologist, I'm not a biologist, but I would assume they would be testing for more than mercury.
Follow up.
So the only thing that this House bill will do is set up a pilot program to put up more signs?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I think it's to look at a combination of things. One would be, one thing that was talked about was putting up more signs. The other thing that was talking about was a broader communication with at-risk populations, particularly non-native speaking populations, and particularly segments of that population that might be exposed to higher risk pregnant women.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Devlin, I guess on the issue of contaminated and contaminated fish, and maybe the health department, when they speak on this, would be able to answer questions, but there doesn't seem to be a definition in here of what we are talking about in relationship to contaminated. And I'm wondering if there is definitions anywhere else in the statute that we should be referring to as far as what is contaminated.
Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to have Mr. Johnson, when you call him up later, answer that question. I can only speak from the limited testimony that we had in the prior session. I'm sure it can include, you know, mercury. It can probably include other heavy metals. It might include some other areas, too. I'm sure I could get a clear answer for the chair either here today or very soon.
Well, any questions? Did you want to stay while we called Mr. Johnson up, or did you wish to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have another committee in about 5 minutes. And Mr. Johnson is far more capable of explaining the technical side of this than I am. I basically, Mr. Chairman, brought this bill forward because I thought it was something that needs to be done. I've worked on a lot of public health issues while I've been in the legislature. This seems to me to be almost a no-brainer. You have people that are consuming fish that represents a danger to themselves and a danger to their unborn children. I know that certain types of neurological damage particularly can occur because of some of that consumption. It's a relatively small expenditure to prevent that from happening, and I'm just hopeful that sometime in the near future this committee could pass this on to the Ways and Means Committee, which is where the hardest battle will occur in terms of trying to get it funded.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, quick question.
Representative Devlin, is this, I think you know, I recently had children, so I was got a lot of information regarding the hazards of eating shellfish or the nitrates in certain bratwurst-type products. So there's a number of these efforts out there regarding specific foods, so I imagine that you'll have a number of examples to follow on to set up the program in terms of the public dissemination of information. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I would believe that would clearly be the case. I remember in our prior discussions with the Public Health Department, that was their desire was to, you know, provide a broader communication on these issues. I think they can probably provide the best answer in terms of what areas that might be of concern, probably better than I can. I might comment on, you know, one of the reasons we focused on mercury is that I'm dealing with another mercury bill in another committee that we have now, and there was recently a Center for Disease Control report issued, which has been characterized in that committee a little bit broader than what the report actually indicates. But in broad terms, it indicates that women having children in the United States, 1 in 10 has a higher level of mercury than is considered safe in terms of the background level of mercury within their bodies. Mercury is one of the most toxic elements in terms of its potential impact on the fetus. We think it's, you know, important that we start to look at some of these issues. I think, like I indicated, Mr. Johnson will be able to provide much more of the technical side of this than I can.
I want to make a comment, though, that there are a number of education efforts I think you could piggyback on with this bill. And I recollect that basically an outreach that we got was warning against any consumption of fish. So I think that this might provide a little clarification to the public effort that's started, at least out there already.
Mr. Chairman, if I might make one closing statement, is that I'm very supportive of this bill. I think there are a lot of people that are supportive of it. The health division is in the normal position to give a caveat here of any department in the state. It was an item in their budget. It was an item that the governor chose not to ultimately fund when he forwarded the budget to the legislature. So I think they will be relatively positive about the need, but they can't advocate for the addition of the amount to the budget because the chief executive has determined that, you know, it wasn't going to be put into his final budget. But obviously that does not mean that the legislature can decide something different from the chief executive and set possibly different priorities.
Representative Devlin, in light of that and the fact that the health department would find it difficult to try to speculate on the motivations of the governor, do you have any thoughts on what the motivations were?
Mr. Chairman, you and I can perhaps speculate on the motivations of the governor. It might be best done privately. We might have some questions in other areas that are not the purview of this committee, particularly relative to some areas of senior services. But in this particular case, maybe part of it is the classic that this would be entirely state-funded. I don't believe that there would be any federal match involved here, and things that are entirely state-funded, like items like this, did not fare very well in the governor's budget.
Representative, I guess where I was going with that is I understand, you know, the toxic effect of things like mercury. But have we had cases on record that we can attribute to heavy metal poisoning as a consequence of fish from the Willamette River?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't have any cases to present here to you today, but I will try to ensure that the chair and members of the committee will do some research and see what cases we can find.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions? Okay. At this point, we call Mr. Johnson, and thank you, Mr. Representative Devlin.
Chair Jensen and members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson. I'm an assistant administrator with the Oregon Health Division in the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3124. As Representative Devlin just indicated, we cannot support the bill because it is not in the governor's budget. However, we can speak to the need that this bill addresses, and the bill does address a very real public health risk. It deals with toxic contaminants in the consumption of fish and the communication of those public health risks then to the community to assure that they can make informed choices. As was indicated, the Oregon Health Division does put out fish advisories. At present, we have 14 in effect, mainly dealing with mercury, and most of those dealing with naturally occurring mercury, but there are other contaminants as well. The first problem that this bill addresses deals with data, and we don't have a lot of data right now. The data that we have drawn on to provide the 14 fish advisories has come from data that has been gathered by the Department of Environmental Quality and Oregon State University. Data gathered really for a different purpose, to characterize the water, to characterize the fish statewide. We do not have an existing capacity to really provide good data on fish advisories, but we have been able to use the data that's available to make the advisories that we put out. This bill would call for us to collaborate with the Department of Environmental Quality and others to do a better job on getting the data. The second risk is the problem of risk assessment capacity. At present, within the Oregon Health Division, we have two toxicologists to do all risk assessment for all kinds of, every kind of environmental risk that is there from contamination of toxicants, consumption of toxicants. That simply isn't enough to do very much. We couldn't do the things that this bill calls for with the existing resources. The third issue that this bill addresses is communication of public health risk to the community generally and to specific subgroups, ethnic groups, people who use fish in unusual ways, to target the information to them, to help understand how they consume fish, how much they consume fish, and then to help us formulate the information that we have in a way which they will understand, which they will receive, and hopefully which will affect their behavior in reducing their risks. We estimate that about $293,000 will be needed to carry out the provisions of this bill in the 2001-2003 biennium. The Willamette is not the only area of concern, but it is certainly one. There are naturally occurring toxicants, such as mercury that was alluded to, and potentially man-made toxicants that could come into play. And again, as I indicated, this the provisions for this bill are not in the governor's budget, and so therefore we must oppose the bill. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions? Mr. Johnson, we're talking about the contaminants here. What's the cycle as these get into the food chain?
Mr. Chair, the cycle is that probably they are put into the water either through man-made actions or leach into the water if it's naturally occurring. The water then deposits them in the sediment. Then they reside in the sediment for some time until aquatic plant life puts their roots into it and has uptake for that those toxicants then to go into that aquatic plant life. Fish, either shellfish or fin fish, eat those vegetation directly, or maybe smaller invertebrates eat them, and then the fish eat the invertebrates and it gets into the fish. Many times these toxicants concentrate in the fatty part of the fish, not so much in the flesh itself, but there is some there, but it's mainly the fatty part of the fish. So that as part of the risk communication, we can talk to the public generally or specific subgroups about what parts of the fish to eat, what parts not to eat, how to prepare fish, how to clean fish, to reduce the risk then that they might have of getting these contaminants, these toxicants, in their own body and then having public health effects.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, you did. The question was raised just before about what other contaminants. Actually, there was another question on the definition then of contaminants. PCBs, other kinds of chemicals that do reside in the sediments can be an issue of concern. I think our advice would be to leave the definition very broad and, in fact, unspecified and simply say public health risks. We know of many contaminants now that can be a public health risk. There may be others that we will find out about in the future. I think the key for us would be if there are contaminants which cause human health effects, that's what would be the determining factor for us, rather than a specific contaminant at this point.
Mr. Chair? Please. Thank you. You mentioned in your testimony that there are 14 advisories in effect, and how are these advisories publicized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomey, at present, the only real vehicle that we use is to publish them in the fishing regulations that the Department of Fish and Wildlife put out. We do not have capacity at present to specifically go to populations. Fish and Wildlife have assisted by putting up some signs. However, we found that signs don't last very long. People can be sitting right underneath the signs fishing for fish and consuming those fish, and they come as, oh, well, that's something that I'm really not concerned about. This river is much better than the river that I used to live by and we ate those fish. So we are not able to, with the resources available, effectively reach these communities in a way which they understand and in a way which affects their behavior. We really need to do a lot of work on that. That's a key part of what this bill calls for.
Are these advisories printed in any language other than English?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomey, at present, yes, they are. They are printed sometimes, not in every part of the state, sometimes in Spanish, sometimes in Russian, and sometimes in Chinese.
Thank you.
Representative King.
Excuse me. Do you know offhand or approximately how many of those advisories are due to natural occurring mercury as versus, you know, other kinds of pollution?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, no, we don't. We wish we could do that. This gets back to the data issue. Certainly there is naturally occurring mercury that is a problem. But we don't know to what extent that is the only problem. In fact, there is some evidence to suggest that man-made toxics are an issue as well, but we do not have data to indicate which is which.
I can leave that.
Representative, what man-made mercury or natural?
Well, I asked that because Kais Grove Lake in my district has a significant mercury problem, and that's, you know, well understood to be, you know, naturally occurring. I believe when I've gone fishing up in East Lake, there's a lot of confusion up there about how many of those fish you can eat because of a mercury, you know, presence up there, and I would think that those would make sense to be advisories, but I don't know if they crossed that threshold.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I think what the chair was alluding to us, it really probably doesn't make a lot of difference whether it's man-made or naturally occurring, but certainly the Department of Geology has indicated to us where the naturally occurring mercury is, and as you indicated, Cottage Grove Lake, that is naturally occurring problem there. However, there are probably some elements of man-made, either from deposition from the air itself, which there is some in the ambient air, or from direct deposit, man-made.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3124 and proceed back to our informational meeting with Mr. Bowles from the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Mr. Chair, so we don't have to go through all of his previous testimony. Maybe he can start where he left off.
Okay.
We'll give you that one for your birthday.
Oh, yes, and we probably should, you know, make mention for everyone here that the good representative is celebrating birthday today, and the years are
starting to show.
Starting to show. Very gracefully. Very gracefully. He has a ways to go, but
I don't want to touch that on the record. No way in the
anyway, happy birthday.
Thanks.
Mr. Bowles.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, once again, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Director for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm pleased to provide testimony on our new approach for managing native fish in Oregon. Our goal is to provide a basis for managing hatcheries, fisheries, predators and competitors, and habitat in balance with sustainable conservation of these native fish. Today, I'd like to do four things. First, provide some brief background, describe our basic approach, and describe the policy components, highlight expected results, and then illustrate a couple examples with respect to our hatcheries. For the background, as you are aware, the existing wild fish management policy focuses primarily on hatchery wild fish interactions and limits hatchery stray rates. Concerns with the policy include lack of support by tribal co-managers and some views that the policy is too inflexible to address individual watershed situations, too inflexible to allow for beneficial uses of hatcheries, and too conservative or liberal regarding wild fish protections. As for our approach, in the response to these concerns and the governor's executive order, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is proposing a somewhat new approach to native fish management in Oregon. First off, I'd like to stress that this approach is not a one-size-fits-all. It will address people's concerns and help Oregon assert strong leadership in balancing conservation with utilization, consistent with state and federal law and the tribal trust responsibilities. One key to this is to shift from debating the differences between hatchery and wild fish to examining the appropriate uses of these fish for society. Society wants fish able to live and reproduce successfully in river, lake, and ocean environments. Society wants fish to catch, harvest, and view. And society wants fish contributing toward ecological health in the watersheds and the ocean. Hatchery and wild fish are important tools to help provide these benefits. The key is to determine how best to use these tools. Our new approach has six key components that accentuate changes that we have made. First, we must recognize the importance and role of both hatchery and wild fish. Second, embrace collaboration with state, tribal, and federal co-managers. Third, determine the bar that must be cleared based on fish performance and identify how to focus and measure our progress towards that. This bar would define conservation more broadly than just hatchery stray rates and would set standards for the overall species management unit, not for every population in every creek. Fourth, identify management flexibility within and among watersheds to meet conservation goals. This part establishes the sideboards for local watershed initiatives, and it recognizes that public policy is unlikely to support the same conservation emphasis in all streams for all native species. This step will explore opportunities for a landscape perspective that includes stronger conservation criteria in the areas most important for the fish, balanced with more flexible criteria in areas less critical. Fifth, increase public involvement. This would be in helping shape the decisions for local watersheds within these sideboards that have been established. And sixth, use existing state and federal planning forums to develop, fund, implement, and monitor management actions. Because of current funding and workload constraints, nesting this approach within existing state and federal forums will be very important. Now, although this process is information-driven, it does not languish in uncertainty, but it needs to move forward through adaptive management. Now, the actual policies within this conceptual framework that I've provided, it basically sets the stage for that. It does not include specific administrative rules at this point. Policies and rulemaking will be developed in collaboration with state, tribal, and federal co-managers. The policy components include adopting the overall approach, describing the bar we are trying to clear, describing the management sideboards, which illustrate the range of flexibility which will be available for the watershed planning, and adopting basin plans developed by the co-managers and the interested public. The outcomes. Well, I believe successful implementation of this approach will, number one, restore or maintain healthy native fish communities and their benefits to society and the ecosystems. Two, will optimize hatchery programs to provide fisheries and aid conservation. Three, meet federal and state ESA requirements. Four, increase local involvement. Five, strengthen local and state influence on federal management of fish, water, and land. Six, increase management flexibility that results from healthy native fish communities. Seven, provide a transparent, stable, and scientifically based approach to conservation. And lastly, to reduce the divisive debate over hatchery and wild fish. Successful conservation of native fish requires a broader perspective than just harvest and hatchery components. Complementary policy development and adoption by other regulatory agencies and tribes is necessary for a consistent and unified approach. Cooperatively engaging our co-managers and publics in the stewardship of native fish resources will allow ODFW to provide strong leadership in the Oregon Plan for salmon and watershed. Now, the pace and success of this approach, I believe, will be largely dependent on the level of support by the co-managers and our ability to integrate planning and implementation into funded, ongoing, or new regional and state forums. There are two hypothetical examples of how hatchery management might fit into this new approach, which are included in the back of the packets you've been provided. The first example is for coastal coho. First map is the overall ESU showing a range of hatchery approaches with among them within these watersheds. The second map is a hypothetical subbasin within the ESU showing more detail on potential flexibility for hatchery approaches. second example is for Snake River, Spring, Summer, Chinook. So the third map in that packet is for the overall ESU, which NIMS regards as the evolutionary significant unit. And then there's another map showing the details for that ESU within Northeast Oregon. I'm sure you have some questions for me. I'd be happy to take those at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowles, the term wild fish come from? Is that an Oregon law or federal law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, as I understand, the wild fish, hatchery fish definitions are from Oregon administrative rules, and I have those in the packet as far as how they are defined and split out. They also define in different contexts throughout the National Marine Fisheries Service and some of their biological opinions, as well as some of their recovery plans, give various definitions to those fish. Different states have various definitions. I have found personally that what we have existing within both statute and rules within the Oregon structure is adequate for the management flexibility needed to treat hatchery and wild fish as both useful for conservation and utilization. I don't think there's any conflict there.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. So you're saying Oregon Division of Fish and Wildlife created a new category called wild fish?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, it's within the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission makes definitions and or in the management of the fish that is quite common in what they're calling a wild fish and a hatchery fish. To clarify that for management purposes, correct?
So it's a Fish and Wildlife Administrative Rule, correct? Thank you.
I think we would have observed several weeks ago when we had some scientists in here from Oregon State that they coined another new term for us to deal with in pearl fish.
Well, I'm totally confused now.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Is it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that National Marine Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife also have definitions. How would they differ from the one in your administrative rules? Or if you're familiar with the differences?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lee, I don't think there are any inconsistencies that would affect the way we manage the fish. They're all basically the same component. Hatchery fish being those fish that have spent any portion of their life in an artificial environment, pulled out from the natural environment, and wild fish being fish that were produced naturally in a given river, lake, or ocean. That's pretty consistent throughout.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I see a lot of positive things here, and obviously when I look at your maps, I mean, in reality, if we're going to go to a new standard and modern hatcheries and different things like that, we don't go statewide simply because, number one, we don't have the funds to upgrade hatcheries on that sort of time frame. But I guess on your presentation here, some good words when you talk about the bar we're trying to clear and sideboards and things like that. I mean, I could go a lot of positive ways with that, but unfortunately, it comes down to rulemaking, which is obviously fairly nebulous and at this point totally undefined. I'm wondering if you have a first cut at what those rules would look like yet, or when you plan on having that first cut so we can see it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cruz, very good questions. That has been something that we've been very concerned about, is the fact that we don't really aren't providing something for you to get your hands around regarding rules, and I know that is a little bit frustrating. The reason we have not is because by the nature of the process that we're proposing here is that it is a collaborative approach, and those will be developed. The bar and stand and sideboards, if you will be developed in collaboration with the other co-managers, state, tribal, and federal, to get us started on that. Now, we do have a schedule in the larger packet that you have, which is the full text. It's about an 18-page document. Within that, at the, near the end of it, is a proposed schedule, and that identifies as best we can, since we're not going to be the sole people driving the bus, kind of tough to give you firm dates, but it shows about when we can expect some things to start happening. As I mentioned in the policy component of this, I mentioned there's really about four policy components. The first one is adoption of the approach itself. And we expect that approach to be able to be put into rule hopefully as soon as this summer sometime. The actual bar to be established would be sometime after that. I can't give you a firm time, but we're hoping that it will still be, you know, by that fall or winter. It's hard to tell at this time. And then you'd be working into the watershed plan. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just touch on the fact that the world does not stop while we develop these things. We have ongoing watershed planning efforts in place right now. And so it's very important that we don't just put a moratorium on everything while we sort all this out. What we'll be doing is proceeding as best we can within this approach as we either gain support or not for it and move forward into developing the rules. But we would adopt this approach and try to embed it into the sub-basin planning process, the watershed plans that we're doing through the Oregon plan, all those sorts of things. The sooner the better. We don't want to hold off a long time on this issue.
Do you have a list of who is sitting around the table discussing this? I mean, you made general reference to where the players should come from, but do you know who the players are going to be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, we have not identified the names of the people. We have identified, or we didn't in the document, but we can identify those that would be responsible. It's basically those co-managers who have statutory responsibilities for stewardship of the fish resource, and that would be the federal, state, and tribal governments related to that. That would be giving the first bar, if you will, on what is required to meet the legal requirements of sustainability, and then the initial sideboards, and then that would be funneled into the watershed planning groups, which is not such a scientific process, but more of a social process with public involvement throughout, as well as the different co-managers.
Okay, I guess, Mr. Chair, I mean, that part of the process is in the near future, not the far future, for you to have that done. So I guess I would be interested in who actually you did have sitting around the table when this was happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How will the bar be determined and by whom?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, the million-dollar question.
Mm-hmm.
Very good one. The bar, as we see it now, is basically the performance of the fish. So it'd be based on the attributes of the fish, either in the creek, lake, or ocean, wherever the particular population resided. And it would be the performance of that group of fish that would allow it to be interpreted as sustainable under state and federal law. And so it would be that level that would delist the fish and allow them to get out from underneath the Endangered Species Act or provide for long-term sustainability of that. That would be determined by scientists based on the attributes of the fish living in that environment. For example, I go through in the in the report itself, some examples of those attributes, which would be abundance of the fish, their survivability, their distribution throughout their range, issues like that. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, the people that would be determining that would be basically those same agencies that have statutory responsibilities for that stewardship, tribal, state, and federal.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Sustainability is a measurable standard. I don't think removal from listing is practical because we don't know how to do that. I mean, the feds have set no standard for delisting, so.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I think you've hit on one of the important aspects of this when we're asking for people in society to provide measures to benefit fish resources. I feel that it's very important that we give them what they're shooting for. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult to know when you've given enough. And I agree that this is not black and white science on exactly where that bar is going to be, but we need to set it, identify where we're uncertain about it, and get on with trying to hit it.
Well, Mr. I agree with that, and I just brought up delisting because we don't know how to do that at this point in time, but do you have a sense that if we can establish something that we consider to be a sustainable population, that we're in a more defensible position to say to the federal government, we're doing good species management, and we should, and tell them to butt out of our business, more or less, which I'd love to be able to tell them that, but they haven't listened so far.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, my vision of this is that it would not be a separate process from the federal process. We would insert ourselves into that and actually, in cooperation with them, help drive this bus rather than just hold on for the ride. And so this would not be a matter of us having our standards separate and then have to convince them. We would convince them through this collaborative process. And my desire is to come out of this with not multiple bars for you to try to clear, but one that is the conservation standard for these different groupings of fish, and that it would have agreement between state, federal, and tribal entities.
Another one. I guess maybe you're getting a different sense than I am that the federal government seems to have an idea as to what they would consider recovery to be. I mean, whenever we've talked to them about how we get there, they really have no answers. So you're kind of thinking they do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, I think they've got some ideas, but what you're hinting at is somewhat of a leadership vacuum that we can collectively fill. And I'm very confident that we can help establish those. Once again, it's not going to be exact science, but it's going to be very ballpark. And I'd also like to state that I have talked about this idea to the National Marine Fisheries Service, and they are very optimistic at our help in doing that.
Representative King. Well, it's been hard to see where the bar is, and you touched on it, but I think a lot of us in the room have a real fear, and I think it is part of our policy thoughts that the stable bar will be real important, because I think we have a sneaking suspicion that when we go over the bar, we're going to find that it gets set a little higher for a new world record every time we get close to it.
I might take a slightly different approach on that and ask, I guess, the question, who can afford to have salmon delisted? half the people in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Fish Division, will be unemployed when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All of the people in some of the federal agencies will be unemployed. And heaven forbid, many of the lobbyists for many of the environmental groups will be running around looking for something new to be dealing with. We've got pretty good industry going here. I think it's very difficult to identify where that bar is. But having editorialized where we probably don't need editorials, I do have a question. There's a buzzword in here, adaptive management. Would you care to elaborate?
Mr. Chair, adaptive management is a jargon word in the Columbia Basin and other places for how you go about with management programs in the face of uncertainty. So you don't wait until you have all your answers figured out before you implement programs. You set up a program, use your best judgment, implement it, such as a conservation hatchery program, and then you establish monitoring programs that allow you to evaluate how you're doing. And if you've made some mistakes, those monitoring programs put up some red flags, and you adapt accordingly based on those red flags. That's what adaptive management is.
Which guru from the management schools of business did this come from?
Chair, I'm not certain about that. I think one of the OSU professors, Hiram Lee, may be partially responsible for that coinage.
I guess, you know, in relationship to the question, it's just intended as a serious question, and we start talking about a new concept, a new idea, and perhaps to many it isn't, quote unquote, so new. And when we borrow it from some other field, you know, we run some pretty good risks of plagiarism and forgeries on the concept. But still, what you're talking about is a breath of some fresh air. We will look with enthusiasm to what's taking place, what will take place. And we'll be very anxious to follow along on your time schedule to see how things progress. We could change some of the elements, of course, in your time schedule here if the legislature and this body would have the courage to make those definitions that you've been waffling along on as far as what constitutes recovery and what is the definition of fish or those types of things, but that remains for other debates to determine. Any other questions for Mr. Bowles? It has been very informative, and we appreciate your being here today and helping us with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on the bill that everybody in the audience has been waiting to testify on, House Bill 3097. The clerk will describe the bill for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3097 is prohibiting the removal of dams or any artificial obstruction on state waters without approval of the Legislative Assembly, directing the Water Resource Commission to take and analyze scientifically viable core sample of sediments behind a dam or obstruction prior to the removal. It does provide two exceptions. Exception number one is that the project owner is a public utility, and two, if the project is licensed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
And with this, we have a list of people, some pros and some cons. And we'll start with Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Eight tests, which to come forward same time, be fine. I'll bring Jim along too. Actually, wiped out three-fifths of my clothes here all in one more.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. This bill was virtually the same bill, and I do have one exception that I'll get to in just a moment. It was brought up last session. It was Senate Bill 987, and it did pass both houses, and it was vetoed, and I do want to distribute a veto letter.
I already did.
Right.
We appreciate, and the record would show that it's already been identified that it was vetoed last session, so future folks do not have to allude to the veto.
The amendment, and I apologize, I really have no excuse other than I just neglected to see it, that Legislative Council drafted a section in on the first page, line 28, through the two lines on the next page, we will offer an amendment to delete those. In other words, it deletes the exception to what we're asking for here because it actually ineffectuates the entire intent of what we're trying to accomplish. The intent of House Bill 3097 is to allow the state government to have a role, a partnership, if you will, with federal government in the decision-making process prior to dam or reservoir removal from the waters of the state. The state of Oregon needs to be involved before federal dams and reservoirs are removed. I understand the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the reluctance by some to have a state law challenge federal activities. As I know we'll be talking about federal works here. However, I was able to obtain documents from the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers under the Freedom of Information Act that may shed some new light on this. The information I obtained, and trust me now, and I'll show you later because I cannot put my hands on it in time for this period. You hold my feet to the fire on it. It is from a required report from the Corps of Engineers to Congress under the Flood Control Act of 1944. In that report, it declares that it is the policy of the United States Congress to recognize the interest and the rights of the state. In this case, we're talking about the state of Oregon. It also says that the governor is to be recognized as a consultation contact for the state or a designated official. In House Bill 3097, this bill, it would make that consultation process go through the Oregon legislature. The state of Oregon is recognized as, in this report that I'm going to give you later, the state of Oregon is recognized as having the right to object to plans for construction. What they were talking about is before a dam, and I'm sorry I don't have the reports, I can't tell you which dam, in 1944, before the dam was put in, this document came to the state and asked the governor at that time, or the state designee, to agree or disagree with the construction of that dam. They gave a number of reasons for the for Congress asking for this. Basically what they're saying is we recognize that the waters of the state belong to the state, and we're about to do something to those waters. And they quote the beneficial uses as for irrigation, transportation, wetlands, and a number of things that they quoted as if they put those works or those constructions into the waters of the state, it could have some effect. So they were getting permission from the state. Now, the bill before you does not tell the federal government what they must do, but it simply insists that the state of Oregon will have the same consideration and rights granted to the state in the report at the time of the construction of the dam or any consideration or removal of dams or reservoirs. This is an implied right to the state of Oregon since they ask in the beginning. House Bill 3097 would allow the Oregon legislature to have the authority of consultation with the federal agencies rather than simply the governor, mainly because the legislators have much more knowledge about their particular dam or reservoir and how removal might affect the economy, wildlife habitat,
for listed or non-listed species, recreation, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we can go through a whole litany of reasons for the dams and reservoirs that we have, and especially in light of this last continuing rolling blackout in California, the lack of electrical power, transportation. We could go on and on. But it is the intent to put the legislative body as a decision-making body to consult with the federal government before any of these federal dams or reservoirs would be removed.
Mr. Schomburg, is it your understanding that this bill applies only to those dams that were federally funded in nature, the Corps of Engineers or something of that nature, or may it apply to other dams that were constructed in the state?
Mr. Chairman, the intent of this bill is to prohibit the state, I've talked mostly about federal issues, but also prohibit the state in this incidence, the Water Resources Commission, from simply causing to be removed any dams or reservoirs from the state without the legislature's approval, unless they are the less than 10 feet high,
okay,
or if they were construction illegally. Those are the two that we would remove.
Yes, Representative Lee.
Thank you. Does this bill not allow then for voluntary removal by dam owners when the owners decide that the dam should either be replaced by something else, such as a pumping station, or is it? It appears from the way I read it that it would include all 3,500 dams over 10 feet high.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, the way it's written at this time, that you are correct. It would prohibit those. Part of what removing a dam can do, as you probably well know, is that it can have some detrimental effects downstream as well as within the dam, the wet area of the dam itself. I personally wouldn't have a big problem, but we've got to stand on one side of this line or another if we're talking about what we're going to be in the habitat and the waters of the state. If they're controlled at present time by a dam or reservoir, then before it's removed, we'd like to have legislators who come from all parts of the state, of course, and particularly those legislators who would be looking at the economic loss or values of habitat within their region to provide the basic input.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is there an exception in here for emergencies then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, there is not, and there should be, and I apologize for that.
Other questions? Lynn? You next.
Good afternoon, Chairman Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pete Test, Associate Director of Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Appreciate this opportunity to comment on this bill briefly. The Oregon Farm Bureau's policy is quite adamant for the continued efforts to store water and continue storage of water where it is at present being done. We have to do something because the efficiency of our water use is seriously jeopardized when 90% of the water is not used at all in the state of Oregon and just runs into the ocean. Storage probably will end up being one of the major needs that we're going to need in the future to really see our state through its water needs. We support the concept in this bill. We recognize it needs some work, but the concept of having a long process with a lot of people involved in determining whether dams should be moved is only right. Because right now, in fact, I'd almost be willing to say we shouldn't remove a dam until somebody lets us build another one to replace it. At the present time, we haven't built a dam in a number of years. So I think the same kind of serious consideration should go into removing dam as goes into building dams. That's the case, at least it leaves a balance, and we do end up in some sort of a position that is beneficial to the state. That is my testimony. I don't have much further than that. Like I say, we really support the concept and realize that there are some limited amendments may be necessary in this legislation, and thank you for this opportunity to comment, and I will answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you. Does this say we wouldn't be able to remove illegal dams either?
No.
It would appear to say that.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, on line 18, a dam artificial obstruction that is constructed illegally.
Oh, okay. So that would mean anything that's over 10 feet higher, would that also mean under, since there's two different subsections to subsection 3 of section 2, was that also meant to include those that were under 10 feet for being?
Chairman Jensen, Representative Lee, the way I see it drafted, and I see there may be a little bit of problem here, but the idea is if it's under 10 feet in height, mm-hmm. it could be removed without legislative approval. If a dam or reservoir was constructed illegally, it could be forced to be removed by the Water Resources Commission without legislative approval.
I think I see the intent of the bill, but I think maybe where it doesn't quite get there is you're probably looking at the larger facilities that have quite a bit of storage capacity, and actually there are 3,500 dams 30 feet or over, so you probably didn't intend to have it quite be the scope that it may currently be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, I'd be happy to work with you on something that could cover that concern. But again, it is the, what Pete said is that we're looking to preserve our water storage capacity as much as possible because we fight over all the water all the time and we have a tremendous amount of wastewater going to the oceans never utilized. And instead of having less storage, we really should be having more storage.
And if I might follow up,
yes.
I don't disagree with you on that. It's just the way the bill is constructed. It does much more, I think, than what was intended, and I would be glad to work with you to help fix some of the problems if you see them as being problems.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you. you said that 90% of the water goes to the ocean without being used. Do you want to have a chance to clarify that? Because it sounds like you're saying if we used it all before it reached the ocean, that would be a good use of the resource. My understanding is that we need good water flow for healthy returning.
Chair Jensen, Vice Chair Leonard. As usual, yes, I will try and be a little more careful with that one. 90% of the water that comes into the state does flow directly to the ocean without being used in the interim.
Without
at least that's without a use other than in stream. Okay, and that's the normal term. I'm sure it might be a little less or a little more, but most people use the 90%. We only really take advantage of about 10% of the water that comes here in the way of dams or for municipal uses, for agriculture, for our purposes. There are values to that water, obviously going to the sea as far as running and live stream ecologically. But there's also abilities to have those values preserved and use more of that 90% of the water for beneficial use, which is what we're going to need in the future with our cities growing and increased populations and everything that we're facing, more efficiently and still not lose those values. And I think there's plenty of room to come up with the right management of the waters to have the ecological benefits that the waters offer by flowing through and still take advantage and use some of that water beneficially in other ways. And that's basically what I'm saying. One of those methods has got to be some sort of, to me, it has to be, almost has to be some sort of storage to hold that water back so it flows when we need it more so we can use it rather than have it fall off just in the springtime. So understand, I'm not saying that it's wasted because it went to the ocean. It's just that there's a lot of water there that we could still use without losing the value ecologically that water may have. And one of the ways of doing that is storage. And right now, we're losing storage, not gain, and we have not really got to the point where we're taking advantage of what we do know to build storage facilities and manage our stored waters in a way that we benefit both to to us as people and our needs, as well as the ecology and the streams and fish down below.
Any questions, Representative Cruz?
Yeah, I guess I'm confused by what Representative Lee was talking about. As I read the bill, number one, any artificial structure 10 feet or more has to be engineered. I mean, so that's a definite standard there. Obviously, they all have to be permitted, but that's kind of a cutoff point as far as construction. So, so obviously anything 10 feet or above this engineered is, by its very nature, a larger type of facility. But so I guess, Representative Lee, you say this goes far beyond what was intended. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. I could use some clarification.
If I might, Mr. Chair, there are 3,500 structures, which include some of what one might consider to be ponds, that fall into this constructed category because it's 1,000 square feet of surface. So I was understanding from the proponents of the bill that they were looking for the larger structures, such as those on the Columbia, the larger reservoirs where there's storage, even in the state, and probably not some of these smaller storage ponds. So that was my question as to what was really the target of the bill, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman, if I may take a shot at clarifying that, we do mean any pond or dam reservoir that, unless it is, if it's less than 10 feet in height, then we exempt it. Okay? And some of these that can even, you know, that are larger than that, or even some that are only 8 feet in height, can well back up a lot more than 1,000 square feet of surface. But to put some kind of a qualifier on here, when do we not worry about the stock ponds and the silt ponds and that sort of thing, that sometimes they might need to be removed by the landowner so that they can be rebuilt or whatever. We want to exempt those and just deal with those that are greater than 10 feet in height. And then again, unless they were illegally, which means they didn't get their proper permits and so on, which the Water Resources Commission could then still require to be removed.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh representing Oregon Family Farm Association, and certainly we passed a bill similar to this in 1999. I'm not sure if it was the same exact language or not, but the concept we certainly in Oregon Family Farm Association support and realize that all those few thousand projects were constructed for a good reason. They had purpose and plenty of forethought, and we would like to make sure that the biggest share of those projects, and that would include those over 10 feet, to have some consultation with the state legislature before removal. And we think that is the body that best represents the biggest share of the people here. And the waters of the state are another consideration why the legislature should be involved in this decision. We realize that these projects, from irrigation to flood control and social issues, recreational aesthetic issues, environmental issues, and economic reasons, we can stack pretty high for reasons for these to be built to begin with. And we also echo what the other two testimonies included in the fact that, you know, these projects number quite large in this state with quite a bit of water on the west side. But we realize even on the west side where we see a tremendous amount of population increase, not only east side but west side is in the future, we need more projects probably to benefit fish and benefit people. And so we want to make sure that the legislature is involved whenever this decision comes forth. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just confused since I wasn't here last
Chairman, I'm confused by this. It's hard for me to understand when the governor represents all the people of Oregon, why the governor wouldn't be the appropriate person to make this decision, and why it would be appropriate to, if it were necessary, somebody felt like it was necessary to remove their dam or whatever, why it would be necessary to convene the legislature in order to make that decision.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, I think just in an effort to address that, I think it's one person versus 90 in making a consideration here, or the executive branch versus the legislative. And some of us certainly feel that we'd rather have, and we can certainly include the governor in on this too, you know, because he certainly is, he or she as governor is included in these types of decisions. But the legislature should have a chance at this, and it should be the body that we feel has responsibility to make that final decision.
I hear you saying the words. I still haven't heard an argument about why that would be necessary to reconvene the legislature in order to make this decision.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, maybe I should take a shot at this. Presently, and more so in 1999, and there was a lot of talk about the federal dams or some of the dams perhaps to be taken out. This is of great concern to a lot of people throughout the state. If, in fact, the governor was that lone voice, and I realize that that person is elected by the people of the state, but when that person was elected, this wasn't as nearly as big of an issue as it was in 1999 and still is. Whereas the legislature still comes back from the place where you were elected from with inputs, and probably on a daily basis those inputs from your constituents, whether it has to do with international trade in the Port of Portland, or whether it has to do with irrigation upstream from any dam or reservoir. But I think the people who have to go back home and live amongst the people who elected them, probably even on the weekends at times during the session, have a much closer feeling on the pulse of the needs of those same people than perhaps a governor would. And the governor oftentimes, of course, then relies on those agencies that are presently making those decisions, rather than, again, the people's legislature.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. At this time, Water Resource Department and Director Paul Cleary. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, Director of the Water Resources Department. With me is Barry Norris, our state engineer and the administrator of our technical services division. I think maybe I'll start off by giving you a report on all of the legal dams that the Water Resource Commission has ordered removed in the last 12 years. I'm done with that report, and I'll move on to the dams that we've authorized. I don't have them for the last 12 years. I can tell you last year we approved 17 large dams. A large reservoir is 179 what we call alternate reservoirs of less than 9.2 acre feet or less than 10 feet in height. We've got some 14,000 reservoirs in the state. There was some discussion about the amount of water that's currently used, or I'd like to use the term probably more diverted from the state. We've got about 14% of the surface water flows diverted and put to out-of-stream uses, but I wouldn't want to kid anybody that the rest of it isn't going to use. Just ask the guys that are trying to bring the container ships up the Columbia right now whether or not they're using that water or not. They certainly are using that water. Our fish are using the water. The hydropower facilities are using that water. But obviously, there's also out-of-stream uses that need water and need to be able to store water.
and I think that the department and commission are concerned about that, have, you know, generally, I think, of the ones we approved last year, 86% of the applications that involved reservoirs were approved within that time frame, and the rest of them are probably working their way through the process. So, you know, we're an agency that approves dams much more than an agency that removes dams. We've got concerns with this bill, primarily because it could potentially jeopardize our ability to respond in a timely manner to public safety concerns. We'd like to think, and we certainly recognize the legislature's authority and broad-based representation, but I'd also like to think that the Water Resource Commission represents all segments of the state. They are appointed from the seven different major basins in the state. They've got broad-based water experience. They're confirmed by the Senate. They're our policy body, just like you're our policy body. And then, of course, we also are part of the administration. We think that they've got a public interest review process that serves the state well. The only dam that or the last dam that was removed due to public safety concerns was the Valsetts Dam on the South Fork of the Sletz River, removed in 1988. And there, the department, group of private consultants, determined that it was unsafe, posed a threat to life and property. We had a substantial public review process, including local public meetings, and we ended up with the owners proceeding to remove the dam because apparently they determined that that was the easier fix and going through with some major modifications to the dam. The concern about artificial obstructions, we can have artificial obstructions of more than 10 feet in height from log jams, flood debris, you know, in some cases, a wreckage. You might remember the flood of 1996. We had houses in rivers. We had trains in rivers. We get boats that are greater than 10 feet that sometimes will wreck and obstruct a river. We've got, obviously, navigation concerns there. You can have coffer dams associated with the development of some kind of structure or even a bridge that could exceed 10 feet in height that are just put in temporarily and then have to be removed. We've got dam removals as part of different basin restoration projects. Down in the Klamath Basin right now, we've got several irrigation districts working cooperatively on looking at removing a current diversion structure that would be more than 10 feet in height. We've got cases where we're consolidating diversions and removing some structures and moving all of the diversion point up to another. I guess our concern with the bill is that there's a lot of times when everyone agrees that dam removal makes sense. It goes through an extensive public process. With this bill, things would then have to come to a halt until the legislature could come back in and take it up. I think that the commission certainly has got the authority to add terms, conditions, exceptions, reservations, and restrictions that are necessary to protect natural resources, health, and welfare. The commission, as I indicated, represents the various interests in the state. We're responsive to the legislature. Again, if you want me to give you an annual report on the number of dams that we remove, I'd be happy to do that because I could give you 12 years worth with a zero. But I really believe that we've got in place a lot of processes that can respond to this concern, the concerns that are evident in this bill, and the bill is just going, in our opinion, is not going to add anything. Instead, it's going to create some problems that are unnecessary. So with that,
Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Cleary. You're referring to the number of dams that have been removed yearly. Can you give us a ballpark figure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tony, since 1988, none were removed by order of the state. That's what I meant my 12-year report was.
Oh, I didn't understand.
It was pretty quick.
But obviously, there's times when owners, as Representative Lee indicated, there's times when an owner of a dam, and I think Glenn Stromberg represented as well, may decide that they've got to remove a structure because of replacing ones. We have some structures that are built in stages where they'll go in with a small structure and then with the intention of actually replacing it with a larger structure down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 feet is not very tall, not when you include the height that's below the water line. And as I indicated, certainly from my experience at Division of State Lands, we had cofferdams when people were doing in water work that were higher than 10 feet.
Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Although, as you said, the department hasn't requested any to be removed, I'm aware of two irrigation district dams which were voluntarily removed to put in better fish passage facilities and store water in a different approach. In both cases, they were replaced, and I'm aware of several in Central Oregon that were taken out because they were a safety structure problem.
Mm-hmm.
Barry may know the ones I'm referring to. So given the nature of the bill as currently written, it's not very workable. Maybe some of those problems could be overcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, good point. I think most all of those being done in partnership with Watershed Council's partnership with the department.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that's the approach that we've tried to encourage.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question of Representative Lee?
Of course.
Thank you. So you're saying that these are removed, the ones that you're referring to. So they don't have to go through the governor, or to whom do they go to
they
get
were,
permission to remove those?
Representative Tomei, they were removed because the owners of the projects requested that they be removed to be replaced with something else.
So who would give them authority to
in those in the cases I'm aware of, the Bureau of Reclamation, the federal government was also part of the project, so they provided their approval as holding title. The district's board of directors approved it. I would assume that Water Resources Commission would have been advised because of the dam safety program, but I'm not sure.
So the governor did not have to
no.
respond to this. Thank you.
Other questions? Could you tell me, Director Clary, is it more difficult to get a put a dam in than it is to take one out?
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that it's probably more difficult to take one out based on the statistics. If you figure that, although there are some that are being removed, the last one that we were directly involved in and was a result of the Commission's Dam Safety Authority was 12 years ago. And in that interim, we approved a number of new dams. If you're talking about federal structures and, you know, what we've seen at least on the dams that are located in Washington on the Snake River, that's been quite an extensive process up there, and we've authorized dams, and they've been constructed in the time period that that study's still been going on. There's, you know, there's obviously concerns, and I think the bill identifies some things that we cover through our processes when we're working with entities that want to remove dams as well, the environmental concerns and so forth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this point, Kimberly with Water Watch. Kimberly, how are you today?
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide comments on House Bill 3097. Water Watch is a river conservation group working to restore and protect stream flows throughout Oregon for fish and wildlife, water quality, and recreation. We have over 800 members statewide representing every legislative district in the state. Water Watch opposes House Bill 3097, which blocks the Water Resources Commission from ordering removal of any dam or artificial obstruction over 10 feet high without the express consent of the legislature. We oppose this bill for three primary reasons. First of all, we feel it would unduly politicize a decision which is properly left in the hands of the Water Resources Commission. The Commission, a panel of citizens appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate,
authorized to make water policy for Oregon is the better form for these decisions, which may involve highly technical questions of dam safety, fish passage, and sediment transport. The Commission has access to technical experts that are best qualified to address these questions, and because it constantly deals with difficult issues of water policy, the Commission has the right experience to handle these matters. And as you heard from Director Cleary, the Commission has representatives from all over Oregon, and currently 3 of the 7 Commission members represent irrigators from the east side of the Cascades. Moreover, whenever the Commission makes a big decision, such as, you know, if it were to decide to require dam removal, there would be public hearings all over the state. The second reason we oppose this bill is because it could put public safety at risk. The Water Resources Commission meets every few months, where the legislature meets only every other year. The commission could make a decision, if they needed to, within a much more timely period. Therefore, this bill could jeopardize public safety by requiring approval, even in the case of imminent threat. And third, we oppose this bill because it is not needed to address a real problem. As we have heard today, the Commission has never required dam removal and is unlikely to do so in the future. There is another provision that is unnecessary as well, which relates to the taking scientifically viable core samples. As far as we understand it, sediment is always considered, if appropriate, when looking at dam removal. So, in conclusion, by requiring the express consent of the legislature for removal of any dam, this legislation would establish a major political obstacle for river restoration and salmon recovery and could threaten public safety. There is no good reason to take such a drastic step when the Water Resources Commission has the right experience, membership, and process to make these decisions. Thank you.
Questions? Kimberly, I'm troubled a little. You're talking about the commission better able to make the decision, and you're referring to its understanding of highly technical questions, dam safety, fish passage, sediment transport, and so forth. They have access to technical experts that are best qualified to address these questions. Are you suggesting the legislature doesn't have that?
No, I am not suggesting that. I think the point there is that the commission is constantly dealing with water issues, and if for every instance of dam removal that comes before them, they can, you know, they have, I think, probably more time and may have more resources to investigate each individual dam. I realize there is a lot of expertise within the legislature and within this committee, and I'm not attempting to imply otherwise. I just... you know, this is the state agency that is charged with water allocation decisions in the state and water policy decisions in the state, and it seems appropriate that they have the authority to make these decisions. And furthermore, they also, you know, they have water masters all over the state on the ground who are very familiar, not to imply that people in the legislature would not be familiar, but they, you know, they have people on the ground as well.
But in both cases, we need to rely on the expertise of other people, whether we're talking about the water masters or whether we're talking about an engineer to assess the safety of a dam, right? I mean... And one would probably assume, at least I would assume, the legislature could identify or, you know, that information as quickly as the people on the commission could understand it as easily as the people on the commission once the reports come in from the technical sort of thing. Certainly, you know, some good points are made, and I think points need to be considered in relationship to some of the issues of safety and the need to be able to respond to some of these issues in a timely manner that could be difficult for the legislature. I think, again, maybe the intention of the drafters of the bill may have been slightly different than some of the things we're discussing here today, and at least at the, you know, for the present, we're going to have to try to get that sort of information ironed out to see whether we're going anywhere else with the bill. I do appreciate your testimony, and as usual, it's well done, and you're right succinct to the point. We appreciate that very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Are there any other comments in relationship to House Bill 3097? Anyone else care to testify on House Bill 3097? Hearing none, the public hearing on House Bill 3097 is closed. Is there anything else to come before the committee? You're good of the order. Announcement? There's no meeting on Friday, we're told by the staff. I know I told you that.
You just made it up.
With that, we're adjourned.